Okay, well, good evening. Welcome to tonight's CLE program, part three of Iowa Trust Balance. This is Richard Clem. I'm coming to you from St. Paul, Minnesota, live this evening, December 5th, 2017. And also, we're recording the program for a podcast. Whichever form you're listening to the program, I take attendance at these programs by a series of code numbers that I will give during the program. So at the conclusion of the program, whether it's just one part or all four parts, please email me those code numbers so that I can record your attendance and send you the appropriate certificate of attendance. My email address is clem.law@usa.net. And if you have questions about my programs, all that information is available at richardclem.com. Well, anyway, we are picking up again with, and we're going to be start with Rule 45.3. During part one of the program, we covered Rule 1.15 of the Iowa Rules of Professional Conduct, which are more or less identical to the rules governing attorneys in most other states, including Minnesota, where I see we have a lot of callers tonight. So that that portion of the program was really relevant to attorneys anywhere. Tonight, and also in part two of the program, which we did last week, we are covering specific provisions of the Iowa Court Rules, Chapter 45 of the Iowa Court Rules. So obviously these rules apply only in Iowa. Attorneys in other states, though, will find that very similar provisions apply to their state. So in Minnesota, the rules that we're talking about here are contained in something called Appendix 1 to the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct. In Wisconsin, they are actually covered in Rule 1.15, which goes on at great length with a lot of these specific rules. And, of course, here in Iowa, they are covered by Chapter 45 of the Iowa Court Rules, which talk about the specifics that go into running your attorney trust account. And when we left off in Part 2, we were talking about Rule 45.3 of namely where you can have your trust account. And here when we're talking about the trust account, we're talking about, most of the time we're talking about the pooled trust account, where you would put all client money that comes into your possession. But these same rules also apply, or at least this rule applies, to a separate trust account, because as we'll learn later in the program, there might be some situations where you have to set up a separate trust account for one particular client. Well, in either case, Rule 45.3 applies. And in most cases, this is pretty easy to satisfy because Rule 45.3 basically says, well, that you have to have it at a real bank. Specifically, it has to be your trust account, either a pooled one or an individual one, has to be at a bank, savings bank, trust company, savings and loan association, savings association, credit union, or federally regulated investment company. Yeah, in most cases, that's pretty easy to figure out what it is because most banks will have the word bank on the door. Probably pretty easy to figure it out what is an actual bank. A couple things to watch out for is it does have to be a real bank, and there are some financial organizations that are not banks. So, for example, you can't have a PayPal account serving as your trust account because PayPal is not a bank, or Amazon Payments is not a bank, or something like that, even though they serve certain banking functions. Well, they are not a bank, savings bank, trust company, or any of the things on that list. So you can't have it there. Also, the bank has to be authorized to do business in Iowa, And most states have that similar provision. So if you're an Iowa attorney, well, your trust account has to be in an Iowa bank. If you're a Minnesota attorney, your trust account has to be at a Minnesota bank. You can check that Appendix 1 to find that out for sure. Most states have that provision that your trust account has to be at a financial institution in the state. So even though a lot of people might have a personal or business banking account with an out-of-state bank. That is not permitted for your trust account. Also, one other thing that could conceivably come up in some situations the bank has to be a bank. And this rule applies to any time that you are holding funds belonging to a client or to a third party in connection with the practice of law. And I don't think the word funds is defined because in most cases, well, we know what funds are. Funds are United States dollars. Funds are money. Funds are cash. Those have to be in a trust account. I don't know exactly how far that the definition of the word funds goes, however. So, for example, what if you are holding Bitcoin that belong to a client? Is that Bitcoin in your possession, does that constitute funds? Now, I would, I think a strong case could be made to say that, yes, that Bitcoin does constitute funds. You can't keep that client or third party funds in something other than a bank. So you can't keep it in your Bitcoin wallet, or you can't keep it on your hard drive, or you can't keep it on some online source. So if you ever do get into a situation where you're dealing with something like Bitcoin on behalf of a client, it might be impossible under these rules. Or at least you should be aware that there is a definite issue there because if those constitute funds, then they have to be held by an authorized banking, bank or savings bank or whatever. As far as I know, if you walk into a bank and say, I'd like to deposit these Bitcoins, I think they will probably tell you no. So that could cause problems. Also, I don't know the answer to the question of what if in some situation, for whatever reason, you are handling foreign currency on behalf of a client. You would have to talk to your banker about that because I don't know whether your banker will be able to, at your Iowa bank, will be able to set up an account at that bank denominated in a foreign currency. I suspect larger banks would be able to handle that. On the other hand, the Farmers State Bank in your little town, I don't know whether they're geared up for that. So if you are involved in transactions like that, you have to be aware that you might have to do some shopping around for your banking needs. The requirement is that it has to be a bank. It has to be a bank in Iowa. It has to be selected in the exercise of your ordinary prudence. So if you're aware that the bank is about to fail, then you probably better deposit the money elsewhere. It has to be federally insured. Now most banks are insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, so it's probably not an issue, not a big deal. Unless you start flirting with the limits of that federal insurance, which in general I believe is about $250,000. None of my clients have $250,000, so I never have to worry about that. If you are handling funds in excess of $250, in addition to that federal insurance, you have to start thinking about that issue of ordinary prudence. You have to be thinking about that a lot more. The rule requires only that the institution be federally insured. So if you if you're holding $500,000 on behalf of a client, it has to be deposited somewhere. And as long as it's a federally insured institution, it meets that minimal requirement. But you have to be aware of the fact that it is not fully insured at that point. Another issue to keep in mind, though, even for amounts under $250,000, is that in general, when the FDIC rules kick in, that $250,000 limit is generally $250,000 per depositor, and that has been construed to mean that each separate client is a separate depositor. So if you have $750,000 in your trust account because you have $250,000 from client A, $250,000 from client B, and $250,000 by client C, then those amounts are fully insured, even though the account balance of your trust account is more than $250,000. So that's where that rule giveth, but that rule also taketh away, because one thing you have to be aware of is that if your client has funds in that bank and your client also has money in your trust account in that bank, the limit of their insurance in general is probably $250,000, because it's $250,000 per depositor. Now, there might be ways to nuance that a little bit to increase the limits, but in general, that $250,000 is $250,000 per depositor. So if your client has a savings account at the same bank where you have your trust account, and they have $250,000 in their savings account, well, you have to remember that every dollar that goes into your trust account that belongs to that client is no longer insured. So you have to select the bank in the exercise of your ordinary prudence. If they have $250,000 in the bank and you're adding another $25, well, then prudence probably dictates that that's okay. But on the other hand, if it is a substantial amount of money, you have to keep in mind that client's funds in your trust account is no longer federally insured, even though other clients might be federally insured. So you have to you do have to exercise some prudence. I would say that for most of us whose clients don't have $250,000 to worry about, I think it's probably safe to say that merely depositing into a federally insured institution probably satisfies our obligation. But when you get into amounts in excess of the limits of federal insurance, well, then there are a lot more difficult issues that you have to think about. You probably have to exercise maybe more than ordinary prudence when dealing with those amounts of money. So they have to be federally insured, and it has to be a real bank. Watch out for things like foreign currency transactions and so forth, because that does present a little bit more of a difficulty. The first code number for this evening's portion of the program is E317, E317, E317 is the first code number for this evening's portion of the program. Now, if you look at this rule 45.3, and I don't know, maybe other states have a similar provision about this, it goes on for a couple of sentences saying that a different rule applies for credit union deposits. If you look at Rule 45.3, it seems to say that a different set of rules applies if it's a credit union. Well, that language is basically obsolete. And the reason why that language was included in there was, until several years ago, different insurance rules applied for credit unions. And essentially, what the rule was, and this is no longer the case, but what the rule was that in order to qualify for federal insurance for credit union depositors, the individual depositor had to be eligible for membership in that particular credit union. So, for example, if I had a credit union account with my alma mater, my college has a credit union that is open to students and faculty and alumni. If I join that credit union, I'm eligible to have a deposit at that credit union because I'm an alumni, an alumnus. So I can have my account there. But just general people off the street can't. I could still have my trust account there, but people who were not eligible for membership, people who did not go to the same school as I did, were not eligible for any of the federal insurance. But that has been changed in the federal law, so you don't have to worry about that anymore. That rule no longer applies. But there is text in Rule 45.3 covering that situation. But again, that is really no longer applicable. So you don't. So yes, Iowa attorneys can have their trust accounts at a credit union if that's what they so choose, as long as it is federally insured and selected in ordinary prudence. Now, what if you have, we talked about this briefly, I think, in a previous section of the program, what if you have a multi-state practice? Well, the rule says that it has to be at an Iowa bank. So now, what if you are, what if you have your office in Nebraska or Minnesota or Missouri, and you have clients on the other side of the state line, and you're admitted in both Iowa and Missouri? Well, the easiest way to solve that problem, because your home state probably has a similar requirement that the bank has to be authorized to do business in your state, the easiest way to deal with that problem in most cases is probably to have a bank that operates in both states, so that way you're covered in both of them. But if that's not possible, if there is no bank that operates in both of those states, well, then you could very well find yourself in a position where you have to have more than one trust account, one for each of those states. And again, you might want to look to Rule 8.5 for guidance in that situation, because Rule 8.5 says, it, in general, this is Rule 8.5 of the Rules of Professional Conduct, because that says that in general, the state where you have your principal office is the state whose law would apply. But there could be situations where it has its predominant effect in another state when you have to comply with that law. So if you do have a multi-state practice, be open to the possibility of having to have more than one trust account. Now, Rule 45.4, as promised, talks about the two kinds of trust accounts that can exist. And normally when I say trust account, you think in terms of your pooled trust account, or which is sometimes called the IOLTA account, or in Minnesota might be called the LTAB account, Lawyers Trust Account Board. And that's the trust account that you normally think of when you have small amounts or either small amounts being held for an indefinite period of time or large amounts being held for a short period of time. Because Minnesota and Iowa have rules in place saying that in those situations, if you have a pooled trust account, it must be an interest-bearing account, and the interest on that account is sent to your state to mostly compensate people in cases of dishonest or in any event, negligent attorneys who lost their clients' money. So I have my trust account. I have $1,000 in my trust account this month. Because of that $1,000, I collected $1.87 interest. Well, my bank sends that money to the state of Minnesota, or in Iowa, it's sent to the state of Iowa for be used for those purposes. But the thing to keep in mind is, whenever that happens, that interest really belongs to your client. So that $1.87 that was taken away and sent to the state of Iowa, that money really belongs to your client. And we are allowed and we are required to have our client's money go to the state because it's a relatively small amount of money, and it's just not worth the extra bookkeeping expense of trying to make sure our client gets their $1.87. So in those situations, basically, whenever the bookkeeping whenever the amounts are such that the extra bookkeeping work is not warranted, then those funds should go into the pooled trust account. However, there are situations where client funds come into your hands or third-party funds come into your hands, you have to remember that always that money, the interest on that money really belongs to your client. So if it becomes a large enough amount of money, it becomes some amount of, you know, greater than $1.87, at some point, if it becomes a large enough amount of money, then you have to have provisions in place so that your client gets the interest on that money. And I believe in the materials here, I have a couple of examples. I'll flip back, but flipping ahead to a couple of examples that I have in the written materials right before Rule 45.4. Let's say right now the banks are paying interest of 2%. I purposely picked round numbers here so I can do the math in my head. Let's say that you get $1,000 from a client, and that's a retainer because you're going to be doing some legal work for them, but it's probably going to sit in your trust account for about a year. But you're getting $1,000 of your client's money, and any interest on that money, remember, belongs to your client. If feasible, you should make sure that your client gets that money. So what should you do with that $1,000? Well, $1,000 at 2% per annum interest, that means that during the course of a year, that $1,000 will earn $20 interest. Well, so $20 is not a real large amount of money. So it's okay if the state of Iowa takes that $20 away from your client, because it would cost you a lot more than $20 to make sure that that didn't happen. Because to prevent that from happening, and what you could do, just because you're such a nice guy and you want to make sure that your client gets all the interest they're entitled to, you could set up a separate interest-bearing trust account on behalf of that client. And any interest earned on that money, namely the $20 that's earned over the course of the year, that belongs to your client. So if you it turns out you didn't bill the client at all over the course of the year, and they get their money back, well, they don't get their $1,000 back, they get $1,020 back. But on the other hand, because it's just $20, that's too much work for you to do. You know, that really doesn't sound reasonable. Or similarly, you get you have a $100,000 settlement that belongs to your client. Now, if that $100,000 was going to be in your account for a year, that would be I believe $2,000 interest. So if you have $100,000 of your client's money that you're holding for a year, that does not belong in your pooled trust account, because that would be taking $2,000 away from your client and sending it to the state of Iowa, and that's certainly not in your client's interest. And furthermore, the cost to prevent that from happening, the cost of you walking down to the bank to open up a separate trust account on behalf of this client, will cost considerably less than $2,000. So in that situation, you would be obligated to set up a separate trust account to cover that $2,000. But on the other hand, if it's a $100,000 personal injury settlement that's not going to be in your account for a year, it's going to be in your account for a week, let's see, $2,000 divided by 52 is approximately $40. So again, it does not pay to do the extra work just to recapture the $40 of lost interest that belongs to your client. So therefore, that $100,000 in your trust account for a period of 2 weeks probably still be appropriate to go in your pooled trust account. But on the other hand, if it's a $1 million settlement and the funds are going to be dispersed within a week, then it's not $40 of your client's money interest earned that week. It's $40,000, I believe. So there, that $1 million settlement, that really should not go into your pooled trust account. That should probably go into a separate trust account because that $40,000 of lost interest belongs to your client, and you have to make sure they get it. Now, maybe something tells me I put an extra zero in that That number. I don't have a calculator in front of me right now. So again, it kind of you have to kind of do that back of the envelope calculation anytime money goes in your trust account. You have to decide approximately how much interest is going to be earned on this money, and if it's a sufficiently large amount to justify your time, your trouble of going through that to save the client that interest, well, then you're really obligated to do that. But on the other hand, when you do that back of the envelope calculation, most times you will discover that the money belongs in the pooled trust account. Now, I should point out when you get that $1 million settlement that I was just talking about, there you have to think very seriously also about those federal insurance issues, because anytime you're dealing with a number of greater than $250,000, you're over the limits of federal insurance for those funds. In those cases, the most common cases, of either nominal funds or short-term funds, well, that should go into your lawyer's pooled trust account, as established by the Iowa Lawyer Trust Account Commission, and namely the rules we're talking about now, and we will be talking about a little bit later on. That has to be an interest-bearing account. Now, if you walk into a large bank, if you do your banking at Wells Fargo or U.S. Bank, or a major banking institution, they will be well aware of all these rules. You never quite trust them to never trust the banks to follow all the rules. But chances are they're going to be aware of these requirements, and it'll be in their system. And one of the options the person there can click on is, this is an Iowa lawyer's trust account. And they'll automatically pull up these rules. On the other hand, if you are the only lawyer in town and you go down to your small town bank and say, I want to open my new Iowa lawyer's trust account, they might not be as intimately aware of these rules, and you might need to educate them. You might need to show them the information, because there are some very specific requirements that the bank has to follow. What they have to do is they have to pay interest at the normal interest rate that they are paying these days. They have to pay interest, and they have to remit that interest to the state of Iowa. In just a minute, I'll talk about those rules. Even though U.S. Bank or Wells Fargo or some large bank is going to be aware of the rules, be aware that Rule 45.44 says that you have the obligation to inform them of the following rules. You have to inform them, if you say an Iowa lawyer's trust account, they'll probably know what you're talking about. But the obligation is really upon you to inform them that they have to collect the interest on a regular basis. I think at least quarterly, and they have to remit that on at least a quarterly basis. They have to send that $1.87 interest collected on your account, and they have to send it to the Iowa Lawyers Trust Account Commission. In fact, you can print out here in the materials the exact instructions that you have to give them. In fact, I think it would probably be a good idea to print this on your letterhead at such time as you're opening the trust account, because again, this rule says that that you have to inform them of that. You have to tell them that on a regular basis you have to remit the interest, and they're probably geared up for that. The other thing that you're geared up for, and you have to ask for this, you have to tell them, dear Mr. Banker, should an overdraft condition ever exist with respect to this account, I want you to provide the Client Security and Attorney Disciplinary Commission a copy of any notice. And you have to mail that to them at 1111 East Court Avenue, Des Moines, Iowa, 50319. You're required to give them that notice saying that if there is ever an overdraft in this trust account, you, Mr. Banker, I want you to inform the Lawyer Disciplinary Commission. And Minnesota has an identical provision, and I'm sure most other states have an identical provision. No matter what, how good a terms you are with your banker, even if they honor the overdraft, they are required to send that notification, and you have to tell them. So you, so probably a good idea to, at time you're opening that account, put on your letterhead, Dear Bank, this account must comply with the following requirements. Because then if the bank is not honoring them, well, at least you're covered because you did instruct them to do that, to remit the interest to the state and to make those overdraft notifications. Now, I'm guessing most of the people taking my program are probably small practitioners. That's certainly the category that I'm in. And we might ask ourselves, well, is this really fair? Because that big law firm in downtown Des Moines or downtown Minneapolis, they probably never have to worry about these notices going to the state, because they will probably, even if they are very sloppy, they will probably never have an overdraft in their trust account. Because if you have 100 different transactions going on at any given time, I have $100 from the Smith case and $1,000 from the Jones case and $1 million from the Consolidated Widget case in my trust account, well, the chances of you ever having an overdraft in the trust account are pretty small because there's always money passing in and out of that account. So if you're the big law firm downtown, you probably don't have to worry quite so much about this because, yeah, you're probably not going to have an overdraft anyway, and that automatically generated notice will never be sent to the state, and you just never have to worry about it. On the other hand, you and I don't have that consolidated widget account, with $1 million in our trust account. So if you have $100 from the Smith case and $100 from the Jones case, and you write a check for $201, well, you've generated that overdraft notice. So we can say to ourselves, is that fair? And the answer is, well, no, it's not fair, but, that's one of many things in life that simply is not fair. We, the smaller practitioners of the world, have to be more careful about these things than the big law firm downtown. And, don't worry, the big law firm downtown, eventually they will, karma will rule in their favor, and they'll write that overdraft check for $1,000,001 or something. So to a certain extent, this is not fair to us small practitioners, but unfortunately, fair or not, that's the way it is. That's what we have to deal with. At this time, I think it's about time for me to give another code number. How about E362 sounds like a good one. E362. Even though we have 3 hours talking about this, I'm going to have to gloss over some of it, I think, because we're not going to have time to cover it all. So one just kind of a little tangent that I will direct you to the written materials is that your bank, if they chose, could impose a monthly service charge on your account. And the remittance that they make to the trust account board, it's sufficient if that remittance is net of any service charge. So if your bank charges a $15 service charge on your trust account, but you've only earned $1.82 interest this month, well, they don't have to send anything to the state. And the client security board would soon be drained of any money. But fortunately, the banks don't do that because in most cases they and again the informal survey I've taken was that over half of the banks don't charge any monthly service charge on the trust account, which is good for the trust account board, but it's also good for us because it makes our math a lot easier. The Iowa Supreme Court has taken the position that an allowable monthly service charge is a fixed amount per month. It is not a per transaction fee. So if your bank decides to start charging a monthly service charge plus a per transaction fee, 25 cents per check or something, that is not they cannot net that out. And in fact, you are really obligated to pay that per transaction fee out of your portion, adding much more accounting. So the best case scenario is that your bank doesn't charge any service charge at all for the trust account. And and if it's a small bank, ask for that. Because tell them because that's going to keep the trust account board people happy, and it's going to make you the customer happy because it's a lot easier for you to deal with that way, and they will make their money on other banking business that you do. Most cases, the banks seem to offer lawyers trust accounts, recognizing that it's a service that they have to provide. And again, here in the materials, we'll talk a little bit more about the monthly service charge. Also things like check printing, of course, that is not part of the monthly service charge. That comes out of your office portion of it. Now, finally, I think, probably could get a little bit further tonight, but again, we're not going to cover all the material here in the written material, but we'll conclude one topic on trust accounts, and that's the lawyer certification. Rule 32.1 of the Iowa Court Rules says that on an annual basis, you have to certify to the state Supreme Court that you have a trust account or that you are never handle client funds. And I believe in Iowa that's done as part of your March affidavit that's sent in as part of your annual bar renewal. And in Minnesota as well, that I have to do that certification as part of my annual attorney registration. And it sounds like my annual affidavit is a lot shorter than the Iowa one. I was looking at some of the requirements on the Iowa one. You have to fill in a lot of information on your annual renewal. Minnesota, we don't have quite so much of that. But one of the things I do have to fill in on an annual basis. Is that, yes, I have a trust account, and I have to include the name of the bank, and I have to include the account number. Sometimes I use my trust account so rarely that's the only time I dig out the checkbook. I have to look up the account number on there. And of course, it's also on the account statement. But you do have to report that under Rule 45.6 as part of your annual affidavit, which I believe you have to do on March 1st or so. So those are the rules governing trust accounts. We're going to be talking about them a little bit more, but now we're going to talk about a kind of a related topic of advance fee and expense payments, namely Rule 45.7. And the reason why that is part of this program is that the general rule is that anytime you receive money from a client before you've done the actual work, kind of the default place where that money has to go is into your trust account. So anytime you get the pay before you do the work, unless you can fit it into one of these specific categories, in general, that money has to go into your trust account. not into your Office account. Because, well, they're, when clients give you money before you do the work, well, what do we call that? Well, we can call it a number of things. We can call it an advance fee payment, and all these are defined terms. An advance fee payment is a payment for contemplated services that are made to the lawyer prior to earning the fee. So in general, in the absence of any other thing happening, if you get the money before you do the work, it's an advance fee payment. And similarly, advance expense payment is defined as, you know, expense money that you get before you actually incur the expense. So if your client gives you, $500, $400 for your attorney's fee plus $100 for the filing fee, well, then $400 is an advance fee payment and $100 of that money is an advance expense payment. And the general rule under Rule 45.7, parentheses 3, is that any time you receive advance fee or expense payments, they go in the trust account, period. So if you haven't earned the money, you have to deposit it in the trust account. And then the rule says that you may withdraw the money only as the fee is earned. Now, when it says that you may withdraw the money, well, it really, I think, should say that you shall withdraw the money, because this rule says that you may take out your money. But, of course, the general rule about commingling says that once you've earned it, you really have to take it out. So that's the general rule, is that if it's an advance fee, it has to go into the trust account. Now, when you do take that advance fee out once you've earned it, so your client gave you $500 in advance to draft the document. Well, you drafted the document, so therefore you've earned your money, and therefore you are allowed to take it out. But under Rule 45.7, parentheses 4, you have to notify the client. If you're accepting, when you get the money, when you get the money, Rule 45.74 says that you have to explain to them at that time the time and amount and purpose of the withdrawal. You have to explain the rules of how this money is going to be coming out, and then it also says that when you earn that money, when you do take it out, you have to transmit that notice the same day that you take the money out of your client, out of the client's trust account. So once you've earned those funds, you have to, you're required to promptly take that out to prevent commingling. But when you do take it out, you are required no later than the date of the withdrawal to send a complete accounting to the client. So keep in mind that getting your fee in advance, while that guarantees that you're going to get paid, but it does not guarantee that there's going to be any less paperwork on your part of sending out bills. In fact, there's going to be more paperwork, because if you send out a bill at the end of the month for all the work that you've done this month, you only have to send them one bill at the end of the month. Whereas if you did get that money up front, you have to notify them the same day that you take the money out. So while having the advance fee can serve as security for your payment, it does not mean that there will be any less work on your part. And I'm going to give our final code number at this point, and that is E396. E396 is our final code number. And I will just cover one more point, and that is Rule 45.7, parentheses 5. That is, you can never, never have an agreement saying that your fee payments are non-refundable. That is not enforceable according to this rule, and since it's not enforceable, it seems to me to be a very bad idea to include that in any kind of contract that you have with your client, because when refundable, the rule says always. You know, if you have not earned a fee and the client demands a refund, you are required to make that refund. Now, you can set up the contract in such a way to make clear that you've earned the money at a certain point, but you should never say that a fee is not refundable. So I see that that brings us up to about 45 minutes. Tomorrow we will be continuing on. We'll look a little bit more about the concept of a flat fee, general retainers, and special retainers, and we will be covering that in part four of the program. For those of you listening on the podcast, again, we will continue with part four in the next segment of the program. Once again, when you've completed listening to the four segments, please email those code numbers to me at clem.law@usa.net. So I'll say good evening to our podcast listeners right now, and I'll talk to the live listeners in just a moment.